This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Well, it did take place in Canada as well, so, you know, who knows what the laws are like up there.
But. Well, that's true. There's no telling up there.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a man who was robbed by the Pulitzer Prize Committee this year, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike.
Rick, yeah. I expected Rick Hess straight up to win a Pulitzer.
I was pulling for same thing over and over.
Yeah.
Didn't quite get there.
I know. What happened?
I think it didn't make the cut.
Waiting for Superman didn't even get into the Oscars, and now this. Clearly, the world does not care about education. You know, when I first saw the headlines that the LA Times had won a Pulitzer, I thought, oh my God, not for the value-added stuff. And thankfully, it was not for the value-added stuff.
Did you see the Washington Post won one for some photograph that the photographers took? I'm like, that's got to be the world's easiest Pulitzer.
Really?
Yeah, why? Like some kid eating an ice cream cone like in Nebraska, and they're like, oh, it captures America, the dawn of a new age.
You know, our engineer and producer Joe is shaking his head. He is a professional photographer. For hire, by the way, for weddings on weekends.
How many Pulitzers has he won?
He has not won any Pulitzers.
Well, they're right there. That's unjust, baby. Injustice.
That's true. He's done some cool stuff.
And let me just say, so I don't mislead our listeners, I actually have no idea what the picture was of. I doubt it was a girl eating an ice cream cone.
That's irresponsible of you, Rick.
Actually, did you see there was a phenomenally cool picture on the front page of Washington Post a couple weeks ago? Somebody standing on this giant, the tunnel bore machine that had pushed through the Alps. Did you see this?
No.
The bore must have been about 60 or 70 feet wide. So it was a picture of these giant steel maws and these wheels and these and this guy standing there who looked like a tiny, it was awesome. It looked like Transformers come to life.
Nice. Okay. Well, with that, we do have a lot to cover this week. We're going to play Part in the Gadfly. We're going to hear Amber's Research Minute. Chris's What's Up With That? Let's get started. Daniela, let's play Part in the Gadfly.
Okay. Question number one. Fordham released our ESEA briefing book this week, detailing the 10 major issues that need to be resolved for the bill to get reauthorized. Mike, what is Fordham proposing?
Oh, thank you for asking, Daniela. So we've talked in broad terms about reform realism before, the idea that the federal government should be pro-education reform, but also realistic about what it can accomplish. We tried to flesh this out in more detail here. There's some big themes. Tight loose is a big one. So we aim to be very tight about the standards that states have in place, to make sure they're rigorous, that their cut scores are rigorous, that they can measure growth, that it's not just math and reading. And then we're basically loose on everything else. No interventions for failing schools. No AYP, no highly qualified teachers provision, no fiddling around with comparability. What we're saying here is basically tight on transparency around student achievement results. Also, we really want school-level financial data, tight on that stuff, loose on accountability and everything else. This is, not surprisingly, getting responses from the left and right that are predictable. The people on the right saying, basically the anti-tight right saying, don't say that the feds should have any oversight over standards. And the anti-loose left who don't like this backing away from, you know, meddling with teacher credentials and all of that.
Mm.
Rick, what's your take?
That I think it is a jargon onslaught. Fordham will measure its success on whether or not it can cram the phrase reform realism and the phrase tight loose into the education conversation. In fact, if I recall, I think Jay Green, didn't he make a drinking game the other day?
He did. And as we knew internally, because we did an internal study after that post came out to find out how drunk people would get if they played the drinking game, we found out the answer was very. Mm. And he reported that today. That some, you know, we used the term tight loose something like 47 times in the paper. That's a lot of shots people had to take.
Well, you guys are hoping to do for tight loose what Mass Insight did for school turnaround.
Yeah, thank you.
And that was a win-win.
Hey, oh, nicely said. We've already done that for tight loose. Tight loose is out there. It's being used. Now we want to do that for reform realism. Come on, just like, you know, you've helped with the new normal. That's in there. Huh? Tough love school reform. I mean, you're not somebody who's never played this game before, Rick Hess.
You guys are masters of the banal phrase. I will give you that.
Topic number two.
Okay. Much issue has been raised over Michael Weinrip's Sunday piece proclaiming that many education reformers went to private high schools. Why do his claims strike a chord? And should they?
No, they shouldn't. I mean, I'm trying to remember the last time the New York Times ran a column pointing out the number of anti-war protesters who had not served in the U.S. military. I mean, one is allowed in a free country, last time I checked, to be involved in public activities, to express an opinion on public activities, and to be politically engaged wherever you went to school.
Mm-hmm. Look, and then to see some of the reformers respond very angrily, say, I went to public high school. Yes, I did. Of course, many of those public high schools that they went to were, you know, a lot like private schools. I mean, they were schools that didn't serve any poor kids and that, you know, you had to get into by having your family buy a house in an affluent area. But none of this matters, right? I mean, look, I think there is a question. It is legitimate for people to criticize think tankers like us for saying we're out of touch with what's going on in the schools. We should at least, you know, if we're writing about this stuff, we should be connected with reality. You know, at Fordham, we try to keep ourselves honest.
I'm not sure how connected some of these critics of ours actually are to reality themselves.
Right. Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. And look, you have made the case as a think tanker that, you know, just like you wouldn't necessarily want a frontline soldier being the one designing your war strategy, it doesn't mean that you have to be a frontline teacher to design education policy.
In fact, we would expect that, you know, I mean, you know, I mean, I hate these games where, you know, I was a teacher once. I am not sure that that makes me a better or worse thinker when it comes to questions of ed policy. It right. gives you certain insights, mm-hmm. but it also leads you into certain kind of conventional routes, and it gives you certain assumptions. So the notion that where somebody spent the year they were 15 or 17 ought to matter all that much, and how we ought to design a nation's school system serving 50 million kids mm-hmm. in 100,000 schools, it strikes me as peripheral at best. And the fact that Weinrip would waste inches in New York mm-hmm. Times going after individuals on this basis is just bizarre.
You know, I think we need to get that computer that won Jeopardy to design our education policies.
Mm.
I mean, that'd be completely scientific.
You know what it would
non-biased.
Spit out? You know what it spit out?
What?
It would spit out tight loose, baby. It's computers like that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Because it's brilliant. Topic number three.
Okay. As his first major personnel announcement, Rahm Emanuel picked J.C. Brizard to be the new Chicago Public Schools chief. What do you think about the Rochester soup slated to take over CPS?
Jean-Claude. So, do you know this guy, Rich?
A little bit. We've traded some. One of his staff, and I think I either taught or known from a couple of years.
Wait. You kind of know him. You traded maybe some emails. You know
emails.
One of his staff.
Yeah, that's about it.
Can you just come on and say, no, I don't know him?
No, I know. I mean, I don't that way. We've seems like the guy seems to have good taste. He's written nice things about some of my articles and stuff, okay. which to me is a positive sign.
It's a sure sign that he can effectively run the third largest school system in the country.
Hey, it's more evidence than we had on Kathy Black.
So, Broad Fellow, or whatever that's called, graduate of the Broad program for urban soups. Yes.
Did he go to private school? Did he go to public high school?
I'm not sure, but he was from Haiti, right? Or served in Haiti? Or?
He's from Haiti, yeah.
He's from Haiti, thank you. We don't know anything about him, do we?
No.
Okay, but nothing. Still, bottom line is teachers hated him in Rochester, and Rahm Emanuel seems happy about that.
Mm-hmm. What does that tell you?
I don't know. I mean, so it's interesting. I mean, so what, you know, is Rahm Emanuel going to actually do a good job here running the Chicago public schools? I mean, he's very brash. He's very gung-ho, but I don't know. Is this going to be the sort of worst of the autocratic instincts that we've seen in other places?
Well, there's no way to know.
You're giving me nothing.
I will say there is a rumor out there, which I can neither confirm nor deny, but that I've heard, that it's actually we've got misinformation as to how he lost that part of his 10th finger, that in fact it was bitten off by an irate teacher when he was 15. So if going to a private school can have such a shaping influence on one's thinking, imagine what happens to having a teacher bite off half a digit.
Wow. Watch out, everybody. Watch out. Okay, that's all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
Amber, do you have all your digits?
I do. Every last one.
Yeah. She's digitized, they might say.
Nice. I think the listeners know that my son, Leandro, now is back down to 10 digits. Mm.
He Excellent. Was at 11 for a little bit
well,
there.
More like 10 and a half.
11 and a half. 11 and a nub.
Oh, well, that's true. Yeah. sort of like that. Okay, what do you have for us today?
So we're going to talk about teacher evaluation today, since there's a lot of buzz around teacher evaluations, how to structure them, how to make sure they have an impact. So we have a new NBER working paper out by Eric Taylor and John Tyler that examines the impact of Cincinnati's teacher evaluation system, or TES, on mid-career teachers, meaning those who have been teaching anywhere from 5 to 19 years. TES is a classroom-based evaluation system where teachers are periodically given in-depth feedback on their teaching practice. Researchers examine district administrative data on students, teachers, and classes from 03-04 through 9-10 and compare the achievement of students taught during or after their teachers' participation in TES with achievement before their teachers' participation in TES. They control for students' prior achievement, teacher experience, among many other relevant variables. They find that participation in TES improves mid-career teacher effectiveness in math. Specifically, student learning in math increased slightly in the year the teacher was evaluated, but the trend continued and increased over time. This means that a teacher whose students had typically scored in the 50th percentile on a math test before being evaluated is able to achieve math gains in the 55th percentile range in the years after the evaluation. Unsurprisingly, teachers who scored in the lowest quartile on their evaluation showed the greatest improvement. No differences were found in reading, however, which is sort of a trend we're seeing in these studies of late. Finally, TES is costly, though, at roughly $7,500 per teacher evaluated. Interesting that this study contradicts other research that finds little growth in teacher effectiveness after a few years on the job.
Interesting. You know, this is going to help people who are promoting teacher evaluation if they're smart, because, you know, the argument now can be, look, we're not just talking about, you know, measuring teachers and trying to fire the bad ones. This is a real professional development experience for teachers. Of course, an expensive one at that.
It's very pricey. Expensive. $7,500. You know, I mean, I remember, the problem is, too, you know, you don't know how generalizable this is. Mm-hmm. Because, right, these programs, we tend to treat them as programs. Yeah. But if there's anything IES meta-analyses should remind us over time, it's that it probably depends whether you do it with fidelity. Right. Probably depends if your staff's, you know, a place like Cincinnati, you've been doing this for a better part of a decade.
Time.
You're serious about it. Mm-hmm. Other places could spend $7,500 ahead and not see much. And the real tough thing about studying this is, I remember talking to John Tyler about this last year, and he was just telling me how brutal it was to assemble these records, because they had to collect and collate all these personnel records on each of these teachers going back and match them up and identify when they were trained.
Right.
You know, it's just, it's tough.
Now, I'm trying to remember, back when they did some studies on the national board, did they show that if you participated in the national board process, you became a better teacher?
You were worse that year. This was Dan Goldhaber's stuff.
Okay.
In the year, it's, I think, the North Carolina stuff, that the year you did it, while you were filling up your box of paper, out years, you were maybe a bit better.
Yeah, which is sort of what this showed. Although this did see a bump in the actual year you were evaluated. But, I mean, Rick's right. This is the Charlotte Danielson rubric. It's like 24 discrete teaching practices. This is the Doug Lamov stuff where, you know, this is the practice. This is what basic, proficient, distinguished looks like. I mean, it's really an excellent instrument, and they've been doing it a long time. They've got lead teachers that come in. It's more of a professional development piece, too. It's not just, you know, check the box evaluation that we see in a lot of districts where everybody, you know, gets great. My instinct is this is more the gold standard type of evaluation.
Here's an interesting scaling question. So what the half of Florida 736 that's not value-added based is observation based, and they're using the Danielson framework. So 60 odd counties in Florida are going to be rolling this out. A really interesting question will be if teachers that go through that seem to show the same kinds of student gains. And that'll be a cool question.
And the math versus reading thing is really interesting, too. I mean, we know from a long time that math, you know, schools have more impact on math than they do on reading. And that reading, you have an impact when the kids are learning to read when they're little. But it's hard to know. If you're a teacher, what can you do to boost reading scores? I mean, it seems like it's mostly in getting kids to read more rigorous material. And so that, you know, whatever you can do to motivate them to read more rigorous stuff and to write about it. But that seems harder. It seems a little more out of the hands of a teacher.
Mm. Right.
Even though reading is fundamental.
Thank you.
Mentioning
that program, RIFT seems to have gotten RIFT in the recent budget. So I think they're a little touchy about that right now. And I do believe RIFT is going to be RIP. Okay.
Bad acronym.
What song goes along with this stuff?
So since we're talking about trying to make teachers their best, we have Simply the Best by Tina Turner.
There you go.
Simply the best.
was the first time in months that the song actually had some relationship to the study.
I think, you know what it was? There was feedback in the prior couple weeks.
Yeah.
That kind of professional development tends to increase the tightness, the loose tightness of the song to a minute match.
You know, Rick, maybe we should provide feedback to one another sometime.
I think the listeners provide it, and the judgment is pretty clear.
What's that?
We're not all that good.
Okay. Thanks, Rick. That's probably true. We're just kidding. People are listening. They love it. Woke up this morning and I got out of bed. Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What's up with that? Yes, sir. Just what you got for us.
All right, well, in a situation that has been unfolding since the end of March in Quebec City, Canada, a 14-year-old high school student found out that a clerical worker at his school was holding down another job, starring in pornographic films. After unsuccessfully inquiring for her autograph, the boy created a Facebook page under her name and uploaded a photo taken from one of her films. While accessing the footage and creating the site from his home, the teen was nonetheless suspended for an undetermined period of time, threatened with being transferred to another school, and even with possible criminal charges if he didn't take down the page. What's up with that? Undoubtedly, some clear moral issues come into play because of this teen's actions. But the school has no business of handing out punishment to anyone other than the clerical worker. The student neither watched her films nor created the Facebook page on or with school property. And to the teacher's claim that the boy stole her identity via Facebook and attacked her reputation, please, lady, Facebook is about as official as calling shotgun to reserve the front seat in a car. And clearly she wasn't thinking about her reputation when she started moonlighting in adult films such as Serial Abusers 2. This kid isn't an employee.
Serial, S-E-R or C-E-R?
S-E-R.
Okay.
Yeah. This kid isn't an employee. He's a student. I'm sick and tired of schools acting like Big Brother in situations where they have no right. If they don't like the negative attention, then don't hire porn stars.
Mike, before we get into this one, I just got to say that if it had been CER cereal, like you could just imagine, you could just imagine the sequel. The case of, the Fruit Loop. The Apple Jacks caper? That'd be awesome. Mike, have you experienced...
Rick, I think you have missed your calling. Were you ever involved in the porn industry, Rick?
Never. Never. But Mike, have you ever had a situation like this?
Are you going to go watch... Are you going to go try to find this movie?
The cereal. Have you ever had this kind of situation, either at your boys' school or at a school when you were a student? Did this ever come up, this whole student pornographic faculty member situation?
In fact, there were rumors that there was a teacher at our school who had posed for Playboy, but I don't know if that was ever more than a rumor. Mm. I did not get to the bottom of that. There was also rumor that one of our teachers, a man, was a male underwear model. But again, these are just rumors that I think middle school kids like to pass around.
It's true. Unless it was actually part of some... meta evaluation to examine your research skills.
Yeah.
See how persistent you would actually be in ferreting out the truth.
Yeah. Now, in all seriousness, the Supreme Court has weighed in on some of this stuff. Maybe not the Supreme Court. Some federal courts have started to be asked to weigh in. Can schools regulate student speech on things like Facebook, for cyberbullying and all the rest? And this is tough. I mean, look, I mostly agree with you here, Chris, that, this kid did a good job exposing what was probably a poor judgment in hiring and, a situation that needs to be handled from the school's perspective. But at the same time, look, I'm not one that says that kids who are not yet 18 necessarily have the wide range of free speech rights everybody else gets.
Hmm. No, I'd be sympathetic if this involves school grounds or school property.
Yeah.
If he was posting on a school computer or what have you. Kids doing it from home. At the end of the day, it strikes me that it's not actually a school issue.
Now, and here's the other question.
And it's not a case of bullying, right? I mean, he's not actually creating he's not harassing another student, creating an unsafe environment.
Right.
What he's doing is posting a picture of a teacher, which she had already made.
Actually, and not a teacher,
available.
A clerical worker.
A clerical worker.
Yes, in the office.
And maybe this is another question. I mean, we understand why maybe a teacher doing porn is a problem. A clerical worker doing porn, I don't know. It's a little more of a gray area.
It's kind of her call, I would think.
Yeah, well, it did take place in Canada as well, so... you know, who knows what the laws are like up there. But.
Well, that's true. There's no telling up there. They're just crazy up there.
Alien exactly. Free, right? It's like you get your, you're like, my porn's only distributed in Canada. Doesn't count. Doesn't count. There's this thing called the internet, Chris.
Okay, again, what was the name of that movie again? No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Okay, listeners, that's all the time we got for this week.
That was a good one, Chris. I got to give you props on that.
Thanks, Rick.
Rick is a favorite. Anything that involves porn, he's for it.
Yeah, I play to his fortes.
Yeah, good. All right. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.